Great to have you with us today as we talk about the latest in Alzheimer's research, including the first blood test for Alzheimer's. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on WPR News. And our guest back with us, Dr. Nathaniel Chin. Dr. Chin's a geriatrician, memory clinic doctor, and medical director for the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Association. And he is also a host of the Dementia Matters podcast, which explores the treatment and care of people with dementia. We spoke with Dr. Chin actually last week about the latest research, and the following conversation is pre-recorded. Dr. Chin, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thanks for having me on again, Larry. Great to be here.
Well, I'll tell you what, earlier this month, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration cleared the first blood test to be used in diagnosing Alzheimer's. What's the significance of this new test?
We know on the research side, Larry, I think it's a culmination of all the hard work of scientists, researchers, and participants in getting to this point, in validating that we can detect Alzheimer's disease in blood. And so I think it really shows the hard work that has gone into the research. And then, of course, it's very exciting in the clinical space. So we are going to be translating what is done in research into clinics, and now we'll be using this in our patients. So we will have better and more accurate diagnoses of our clinic patients and being able to tell them what is happening in their brains, that we do think Alzheimer's is present, and now we can prove it with a blood test.
How many people roughly are there living with undiagnosed, untreated Alzheimer's?
Oh, wow. That's a really hard question, Larry. I mean, we know that of those 65 and older, that there's over 7 million people with Alzheimer's dementia. And we know there's over 5 million people with mild cognitive impairment due to Alzheimer's. And when we think about the presence of just that first protein of amyloid, we know there's probably over 40 million people who have just that protein. And so how many people who probably have symptoms, you know, it's in the millions. It's just a lot of people who are experiencing thinking changes. Those thinking changes could be related to this protein. But I don't want to say that as a scare people. You know, there's a lot of reversible causes too. And so to be clear, you know, when people experience memory loss or thinking change, you know, we tend to try to look for the reversible factor first, like sleep apnea, medication side effect, and so on. But there's a lot of people who likely have undiagnosed cognitive change due to this protein.
I'm wondering, how does that work? What's in your blood that signifies that you have Alzheimer's?
Well, I think the big thing here is that we really are redefining Alzheimer's disease. You know, in the past, people thought Alzheimer's was the same thing as dementia. And those are two separate things. Dementia being someone with thinking changes on testing, and the most importantly, changes in their day-to-day activities where they just simply can't do some of the things they used to do. Alzheimer's disease now being defined as the presence of two proteins that are building up in the brain. The first protein being called amyloid, and then years later, the second protein being called tau. And so for years, we've been able to identify amyloid and tau in the spinal fluid, which is when people get a lumbar puncture. And then for decades, we've done really great research showing that we can detect that with these fancy PET scans, these imaging scans. But now, with the, you know, the great work that's happening here in Wisconsin in particular, we've validated that the proteins, these amyloid and tau proteins in the blood actually are reflected the same ones that are found in the spinal fluid and in those PET scans.
Pretty cool. How long does it take you to come up with, you know, after you take the test, how long does it take to, you know, find out for sure?
Just days. You know, and frankly, in the research side, it's really just hours that we could do this. But, you know, in a clinic setting, it's just sort of like getting a, you know, cholesterol panel or screening for diabetes. You get the blood drawn and a day or two later, it would result in your electronic health record. And depending on the arrangement of your healthcare institution, potentially you as the patient would be able to see this, or possibly it isn't yet shared and your healthcare provider would call you and talk to you about that result. It just depends on on the arrangement. This is a very sensitive piece of information, and so it may not be as readily accessible as something like your cholesterol panel, but it doesn't take very long at all, Larry.
Yeah, I would think if I went to my went online and looked without knowing that suddenly I'm a candidate or I have early Alzheimer's, that would be something I probably wouldn't want to know without talking to somebody in person or have them tell me in person.
Exactly. And I think one of the key things that I hope the listeners take away from our conversation is that a lot of counseling goes into just whether or not you want to get this test, you know, what the different results could actually mean, and then what the process looks like afterwards. You know, at University of Wisconsin Health and Clinics, UW Health, we've been sharing blood test results about Alzheimer's disease with our clinic patients for a while. And I will tell you, it is not a simple yes or no, you have it or you don't have it conversation. This takes a while to talk about. This is a lot. This is heavy information. And so it is a long conversation. And you really have to prepare people before they even get the test, and then actually sitting down with them and talking about the significance and the meaning of it. And so it is more than just yes or no.
Yeah, I read somewhere that sort of currently primary care doctors maybe correctly diagnose patients with only about 60% of the time. And this blood test is more accurate.
Yes, there has been a study that's out there. It was done in Europe, and it showed that primary care doctors were about 50 to 60% accurate at diagnosing Alzheimer's disease, that pathology specifically, and that memory care specialists like myself were about 70 to 80% accurate with all the tests available to us. And then this blood test is about 92%. Now, I'm going to push back on that result and just say, you know, human beings are more than just a simple singular test designed to detect this protein. And there's a lot that goes into this. So, you know, clinicians are really skilled at talking to people and understanding the experience of our patients. And so we can do a lot more than just look at pathology. And we provide a lot of care and intervention during our history and our interviews. And so this test is really good at detecting this singular protein. But certainly can aid in the evaluation process that clinicians and primary care doctors are capable of doing. And so, you know, I know there is a lot about, is a blood test better than your clinician? And I don't think that's true. I think our clinicians are excellent, or primary care doctors are excellent, but this is a great tool to help us in being even better.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I'm wondering who could take this test. I mean, could anybody go into their primary and say, hey, I want this blood test?
Well, as of now, the FDA approved this test for people in a specialty clinic. So that would usually be a neurologist, a geriatrician, or a memory clinic provider. And it would be for individuals who have a diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment or dementia. So it would not yet be in primary care, and it would not yet be for people who are cognitively healthy or don't have any symptoms. When the FDA looked at the evidence or the data, it was really just in the people, the participants who had impairments. So they validated it just for those who already had cognitive change.
Yeah. How were UW-Madison researchers involved in developing this blood test?
Yeah, so my colleagues were very much involved. So they contributed 40% of the data that was used by the FDA to make this determination. And that means that the Great Wisconsin participants, so the Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, those participants, and then the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention, the RAP study, those participants. So about 200 of them donated or gave their blood and their spinal fluid, and they had to do both. And so they did blood draws and lumbar punctures, and so they gave those samples, and then they were analyzed, and they showed that the proteins in the blood matched the proteins in the spinal fluid with good accuracy, and that was really what was used to show that this blood test was good enough to be used in the clinical space. And so 40% of that data just came from our centers.
Oh, that's very cool. It's got to, I think, in order to, for a test to be approved by the FDA or cleared, I guess I should say, you need a lot in order to have it cleared.
Oh, absolutely. We need to be confident that what we're measuring is true, that it has a high standard, because we don't want to be using data that we're not sure about or tests that we're unclear about when it comes to our clinic population. You know, in research, we can have this open, honest conversation with participants about what we don't know. But in clinic, when we're making treatment decisions about this, when it's not voluntary, it's about clinical care, we have to have the highest standards. And so for the FDA to approve this test, it really showed that it met those high standards.
And I'm wondering the benefits of, or should I say, what benefit is there to catching Alzheimer's early before it's progressed?
Well, I think there's a lot of benefit to knowing what's happening. So I think just the personal benefit of putting a name to something that you've been experiencing in understanding this is the reason I've been experiencing these changes, or for family, putting a name to what you've been witnessing. So often you're struggling with why is this happening? What's going on with my loved one? And so this is a confirmation that something is going on. It's not just them doing this. And then, of course, earlier intervention. And so whether it's a referral to a clinical trial, or now there are two FDA-approved medications to remove this protein, this amyloid protein, and so that would be a treatment option. Or it's just other care. I mean, these medications are only a part of clinical care. And so having a diagnosis means, or could mean, that a person engages in other treatments, other lifestyle interventions, other care supports. And it can be really motivating for someone to say, this is what's happening to me. I know this, and now I'm going to move on. I'm going to move forward and take the next steps to live the best life that I can.
You know, I know someone whose mother had Alzheimer's, or was at least diagnosed with it, whose brother had it, and whose sister has it. Makes me think that there's some family history involved with Alzheimer's. How much does family history affect Alzheimer's risk?
Yeah, this idea of family history is real. We know that Alzheimer's can quote, run in families. A lot of times, though, that is related to a particular risk gene, and it's called apolipoprotein E, or as most people know it, ApoE. And it's called a risk gene because it's not a guarantee, meaning you can have it, ApoE4 in particular. This is the risk gene. But it doesn't mean you're going to develop Alzheimer's. It just means you're at a higher risk of it. And so many times when people describe having multiple family members, you know, if they were to do their genetics, they could have one or two copies of this ApoE4. And so that would be one. There are other risk genes as well, but they're not as influential or impactful as ApoE4. There is another type of Alzheimer's called early onset Alzheimer's, or autosomal dominant. And that's the type where, if you were to see it on TV, where people are developing Alzheimer's dementia in their 30s and their 40s and their 50s. And this is where you have one of these copies and you're going to develop Alzheimer's disease. It's less common. It's 1-2% of the time. And that truly does run in the family, but that's usually not the case when you're hearing those stories. It's usually one of the ApoE4 stories or different type of risk gene.
Mm. Dr. Nate Chen, our guest today, he is the medical director of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. At 11:30, a dementia care expert joins us to talk about how to communicate with your loved one experiencing memory loss. And at noon today, we will turn our attention to dental care. Right now, I'm talking with Dr. Nate Chen we started talking about the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's clearing of the first blood test to be used in diagnosing Alzheimer's and its significance. So glad to have you with us today as we talk with Dr. Chen. Currently, how do doctors diagnose Alzheimer's? Is it just by experience primarily, or?
You know, in general, most memory specialists, neurologists, primary care doctors would try to diagnose the syndrome of mild cognitive impairment or dementia first. That's sort of a collection of symptoms, using history, ruling out reversible causes, doing some cognitive testing, a physical exam. And then you do get some blood work, some standard blood work, trying to rule out certain conditions, and then potentially a CT or an MRI of the brain scan. And again, that's trying to rule out certain conditions. And then ultimately, it is your clinical judgment. It's your history, the cognitive tests, and really just based on your experience. There hasn't been the ability to rule in, meaning that really I confirm the biological cause of Alzheimer's disease for some time, although I will say specialists have been able to use spinal fluid. It's just that it hasn't been as common. And so the blood test is going to really change the way we approach the confirmation of Alzheimer's disease.
And I'm wondering, what are the conditions that often get confused with Alzheimer's?
Well, I would start by just saying most people think Alzheimer's is the same thing as dementia, and that to this day, most people will think that. And that's, there's a lot of stigma because of that. And that's unfortunate because many people can be diagnosed very early with mild cognitive impairment, where they're having just a couple of thinking changes, some mild forgetfulness, and they'll just have one, maybe two sort of lower scores on their thinking tests, and that's it. They can do everything they day-to-day activity-wise. They're very independent, very capable individuals. And then we find out that they have this amyloid protein in their brain. And so that technically is mild cognitive impairment due to Alzheimer's. And so people can get confused by the Alzheimer's part and think, oh, no, I have dementia, when actually they have mild cognitive impairment. And so Alzheimer's is not the same thing as dementia, dementia being just a further along part of the process. And then I would say many people think that all memory loss is due to Alzheimer's disease, and that's also not the case. You know, memory loss can be due to lots of different things, medication side effects, sleep apnea, depression, hypothyroidism, so having a low thyroid. And so it's really important to evaluate for those conditions first, because those are all very treatable. And if we do get to those early enough, we can actually reverse memory loss completely. By treating those conditions.
Yeah. And I know I have friends who have done this, and I've done it myself. You kind of, maybe you forget where you put the car keys, or you might meet up with somebody that you know, and it takes you a second or two or longer sometimes to come up with their name. Is this some kind of precursor to dementia or Alzheimer's?
Usually not, Larry. So usually that would be what we call normal age-related change. And that tip-of-the-tongue phenomenon, or walking into a room and forgetting why you did that, which is usually more of an attention issue than it is a memory issue. When they happen sporadically, or when that name does eventually come to you, or that word eventually comes to you, that's usually not an issue. The one thing that is hard, though, is it is hard to differentiate normal aging from something that is pathological, which is why you ideally you would report that to your primary care doctor and potentially have, evaluation. But more often than not, unless it's persistent, unless it's being noticed by others, unless it's really interfering with how you get through the day, there's a good chance that it is just normal aging. It doesn't mean ignore it. It just means perhaps don't panic as much. And talk about it and really see if there's other factors, like you're just not sleeping as well, or perhaps you're having too much to drink, or perhaps you're, there are other factors. And so before jumping to the conclusion that it's Alzheimer's disease.
Okay. Oh, man, I've thinking about this blood test, a great sign of progress here. And I'm wondering, in the last, decade or so, how is our knowledge of Alzheimer's disease expanded?
It is rapidly accelerating. It's taken us a long time to get to this point, Larry, because it's been so hard to really identify the proteins of Alzheimer's disease. And now that we've been able to do that, we can really understand, well, what are the factors that are leading to the development of this protein? What's happening between amyloid and the development of the next protein? What is lifestyle doing that could be modifying this? what are the social determinants of health? What are the lifestyle or what are the environmental genetic access issues that could be affecting how our brains are functioning and our ability to think? And so it really helps form a framework for researchers to ask really important questions. And then, of course, then it expands into other areas of brain disease. And so this is one blood test looking for Alzheimer's, but there are going to be other blood tests looking for the other brain diseases like Lewy body disease and TDP-43 is another different protein. And so it's really allowing for the field to get to a point where we, with a simple blood draw, can look for multiple different brain processes to help people figure out what's going on and what are the different interventions that we can do to help you.
Yeah. I'm wondering if there ever could be a cure. I mean, how close are we? Are we a million miles away from a cure for Alzheimer's?
Cure is harder because we would have to stop the disease and then bring brain cells back. But the idea of stopping the disease in its tracks is certainly feasible. We have to be able to identify the disease, come up with interventions to stop it. And that's something I think the field is working on. And then also prevention. You know, I mentioned we're part of the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention Study. That's the RAP study. We're very focused on this idea of, you know, how can we prevent the development of these proteins or the development of symptoms? And now that we can identify this in blood, you know, what do those interventions look like? What is the lifestyle? What are the social environmental factors? What are the pharmaceutical treatments that we could be giving to prevent this? And so I think the field is expanding in that area. And so that seems much more feasible. Cure is not out of the question. It just seems a bit further out than this idea of disease modifying, stabilizing, and ideally preventing.
Yeah. That would, I don't think we'll see that in my lifetime, but let's hope down the road that we have something like that. The difference between dementia and Alzheimer's, I mean, can dementia be cured?
Well, so dementia is when you actually are losing and you've lost brain cells. And so, you know, the goal would be, can we stop the worsening of dementia? Can we stop whatever the disease is that's causing those, you know, brain cells to die? That would be the goal. And then there are clinical trials actually looking to grow brain cells. You know, what can we do to generate more brain cells? And what we do know is you can generate more brain cells and you can generate connections among brain cells called synaptogenesis. And actually one of the best things you can do for that is exercise. And so, but they're looking at drugs too. And so it would take stopping disease and then, you know, growing more brain cells. And there are scientists looking at that. So the field is very broad and diverse, and they are considering that. And so it's not out of the realm of possibility, but that certainly is a hard thing to do.
And the prognosis for someone diagnosed with Alzheimer's?
Well, as of now, this is a terminal condition. And so in general, you know, when you are diagnosed with dementia due to Alzheimer's disease, they say it's anywhere between 5 and 9 years before you would pass away. You know, we see longer courses than that, and we see shorter courses. And I would certainly say now people know so much more than they did years ago. And so we certainly see the quality of life improve compared to decades ago. And there's lots of great resources and care supports for people living with Alzheimer's, living with dementia, and their care support, their care partners. And so we do know that when you support the people caring for people living with Alzheimer's and those living with dementia, the end result is better. And so we are doing a better job in providing care than we did decades ago.
Dr. Chin, it's been a great pleasure talking with you today. I really appreciate your time, and I'm sure we'll be calling you back. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on, Larry.
Dr. Nate Chin, Medical Director of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. Thanks to him, and we'll be right back after these messages. I'm Larry Mueller. Communicating with others is often challenging, and if you add dementia into the mix, it gets more complicated. Larry Mueller, and thanks for joining us here on WPR News. We'll be talking about how to talk to someone who has dementia with our guest, Rachel Wunderlin. Back with us, she's an internationally recognized dementia care expert and educator. Rachel has a master's in gerontology and is a three-time published author with Johns Hopkins University Press. Rachel is the owner of Dementia by Day, a dementia care consulting firm and education company. At noon, we'll turn to dental care and the latest technology that can help you keep your teeth clean. But right now, we want to hear from you. How do you communicate with your loved one who has dementia? What has been your experience? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. Rachel Wunderlin, welcome back. Great to have you with us.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
So let's talk about the challenges. What challenges do people with dementia face when they try to communicate with others?
It can range. So the person living with dementia may have some form of aphasia, which affects their ability to communicate verbally. It may also be that they communicate verbally just fine, but what they're saying may not always be what they mean or what the person who's caring for them hears. So the challenge is often for the caregiver for the person living with dementia and how they're going to respond if the person living with dementia says things that in our reality aren't true or aren't on our current timeline or what have you.
Yeah, I'll probably bring my brother Mitch into this conversation. He passed away a few months ago with dementia.
I'm sorry.
And it can be tough sometimes. Why is patience, I had to learn patience, important for care partners or for loved ones visiting someone in a community?
One of the key things here, I think, is with patients being able to take a step back and realize that the person you're talking to, they're not asking you the same question 3 million times to frustrate you, even though it will frustrate you. They're not remembering that they asked that question many times before. So it falls upon really the caregiving partner to be the one to accept the fact that they've been asked that question a million times, but it's okay.
Yeah, and talking with my brother, I was irritated at first, and then I thought, well, wait a minute, you're the lucky one. You've got a great job. You got, you interview people. You have a nice living here. So, hey, don't feel sorry for yourself, I think is what I finally had to say to myself, and that, I think that actually helped me.
It's hard. It's really hard, and I tell caregivers frequently, dementia care communication, it's sort of like learning a different language in a lot of ways. We teach something at Dementia by Day, my company, called Embracing Their Reality, which is this idea that we're going to do whatever's true for the person living with dementia, no matter where it is. Take the word lying or therapeutic fibbing or whatever out of your vocabulary, throw it out the window, and focus on, okay, what's true for them? Let's do that.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good way to look at it. We had many conversations about his car and how his car was doing, and I had sold his car many months earlier, but yeah. I never discussed that with him. We just talked about the car, which he loved that car. What are the best environments for a conversation with someone with dementia? And maybe places to avoid as well.
Well, for one, I would never try to bring somebody living with dementia back into our reality. A physical location you would not want to bring them to, for example, is the cemetery to prove to them who's died, or their old house or apartment to prove to them that they don't live there anymore. We really want to avoid the proving part. Mm-hmm. And I think that's hard for a lot of people because, you know, when you're in a discussion with somebody, say your spouse, you know, you want to be correct, you want to be the person who wins that argument, you're going to present a bunch of facts that support your end of the argument. But when we're talking to somebody living with dementia, we have to remember that their facts are no longer necessarily our facts, at least not on this timeline. And so we have another phrase we call timeline confusion, which is this concept that someone living with dementia may be very much living in a nonlinear timeline. They may feel like they are 20, 30, 40 years younger than they currently are, and sometimes will have trouble placing loved ones or friends on their timeline because of this. So they may see, you know, a sibling and think, well, this can't be my sister. You know, she looks like she's 70 years old. So my sister is only, you know, 30. So this must be our mom. This must be our, you know, our grandmother, our aunt, whatever.
Well, what are some topics of conversation that you might brainstorm ahead of time?
We always recommend bringing something to do with a person living with dementia. So this could be as simple as a bunch of socks that you all need to fold and sort. So asking the person for help instead of saying, hey, do you want to fold socks? Because no one wants to do that. Saying, can you help me with this? Can you help me put these socks together? Another option would be to bring something. These are online. They're called finishing lines or finishing lyrics. And so it's literally a book of lyrics or quotes that the person will fill in the blank for. So, you know, stay off of my blue suede shoes, right? So the person would say blue suede shoes. And being able to even fill in those blanks makes someone feel really successful and, you know, happy. So if you can bring something with you to do with them, that's going to be a great conversation starter and take some of the pressure off of you as a caregiver trying to brainstorm, oh my gosh, what am I going to say to this person, you know, when I'm there?
Yeah, I found a little scrapbook that had all of the pictures of his class from grade school with fairly large photos. And so I took that in and I said, I can't figure out who all these people are. Let's try and figure this out. And we spent about 45 minutes going through that list. And then that led to some conversations about the individuals who were in each photo. And
right.
It was fun for him. It was actually fun for me.
Right, exactly. Yeah, you came with a plan and executed on that plan. And I think that's really, really helpful.
Yeah. Well, let's talk more about embracing their reality. Is this school of thought different from other methods out there?
Yes, actually, yeah. There are a number of schools of thought. I think most people in the industry agree at this point that the idea of reality orientation, saying like, don't you remember you're 90 years old and you live here now? I think most people agree that that's not good. But other schools of thought, like the validation theory that a lot of people subscribe to, say, okay, sure, yeah, you kind of want to go to their world, but you don't want to lie to them. And so that's where embracing their reality, I think, really lives and exists in this gray area, because I'm saying, hey, let's take the word lying. Let's get rid of it. Let's toss it out of our vocabulary, because when we're lying, we're typically doing something deceitful on purpose in order to, what, you know, win an argument or whatever the case may be. But when we're talking to somebody living with dementia, all we want to do is make sure they have a better day and make sure we have a better day. And so when we focus on, wait a second, let's not worry about what is lying and what's not lying. Let's worry about what's true for this person. You know, who do they believe is still alive? Where do they believe they live? How old do they believe they are? all these things can exist and be true in their reality. And living in that world with them is going to be such a better experience for everybody.
Our guest today, Rachel Wunderlin, internationally recognized dementia expert, care expert, and educator. And I hope you'll join in with your own thoughts on this. Questions or comments or maybe an experience to share. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. For people with dementia, time isn't linear like it is for those of us without. Are there ways to partners can help with timeline confusion? You were talking a bit about it, but expand a bit.
Sure. So I always bring up this one example, which is the movie The Notebook. It came out in 2004, so it's been out for quite a while. And in this movie, I think they do a really, really bad job with dementia. So the concept is this guy comes to visit his wife every day at her senior living building. She has dementia, and she never knows who he is, according to the plot of this film. So one day he goes in, suddenly it's like dementia is like a hat, right? It's almost like she took off the hat. She knows who he is. She's like, oh my God, how long before I forget again? He says, last time was only a few minutes. And she's like, oh, okay. And then 5 seconds later, she's really confused again, has no idea who he is. That's a super Hollywood version of dementia and really doesn't work that way. What would probably be more likely is that if she had trouble placing him on her timeline, she may see this older gentleman and think, this guy looks familiar. He sounds familiar. I know that I care about him. He must be my dad. He must be my uncle, right? Or someone else important to me, instead of just like, oh my God, I've never seen this guy in my life. I have no idea who he is.
I would approach Mitch when I walked in. I said, your brother Larry is back to talk with you about whatever, and just in case he didn't know.
Yeah, one challenge that, that could have presented is that if he was like, what do you mean? What do you mean you're my brother? My brother's 25 years old. What are you talking about? So I often encourage people to introduce themselves, but leave the relationship out. So you could say, hey, it's me, So I would walk in, hey, it's Rachel. And Rachel can be whoever to that person. So at the end of his life, my grandpa had some cognitive impairment at the end of his life. And when I went in to see him, he said, who are you? I said, I'm Rachel. And he was like, okay, great. And then another time I went in and he said, who are you? And I said, he said, you're not my wife. And I said, that's true. I'm Rachel. And he was like, okay. and that was good enough, because I don't want to say I'm your granddaughter, because if he is already thinking, is this my wife? Well, probably we're not mixing up someone who's, in their mid-30s with someone who's in their 80s or 90s, early 90s, right? So I just let him tell me what our relationship is. And the important thing is, you're still important to that person living with dementia. They just might not be able to figure out why you're so old, They might not be able to figure out, how the heck are you? How are you, 70 years old when I'm looking for, a 25-year-old person?
Well, I like your approach better than the one I used. Although he did seem to respond.
I'm glad it always worked out. And, I don't want to, I think it sounds like you did a great job. It's a very nuanced approach to it, but it kind of keeps you from getting painted into a corner, accidentally, if he's like, wait a second.
Cheryl in Iron Ridge, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call. And the first thing I want to say is I have an experience with my aunt. And I'm just so grateful she remembers who I am, okay? And I spend the day with her for 2 days, but our history is my whole life. She was like a mom to me, okay? And all I have to say is listening to this program couldn't be more appropriate, because when you spend an entire day with somebody who literally will ask you the same question 15 times.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we lost her. It could be frustrating. I don't know if that's what Cheryl was going to say, but we lost her there.
Yeah, probably. It's exhausting, you know. And also I want to say to her, you know, even if her aunt has at some point some trouble, quote unquote, knowing her, it's not that she doesn't know her. It's just that she can't place her in her timeline. So her aunt will never not know her. It could at some point reach a place where her aunt can't figure out why she's a grown up person, you know, and she's looking for a younger person. So it's not they don't know you. It's not that they don't love you. It's just that they can't place you on their nonlinear timeline, just in case that happens. And it doesn't always happen.
Molly in Cassville, we'll go to you. Hi, Molly.
Hi. I have a story just to reiterate about getting into their world with them. My mother had Alzheimer's for 11 years, and towards the last year or so, she would get sundowners in the evening where she'd get very agitated, and she wanted to go home. And home for her was her parents. And my mother was in her 80s. So they weren't there anymore. And my father's approach was to try to sit her down and say, well, Mary, this is your home. There is no home there. Your parents are dead. And that just did not comfort her at all. Mm-hmm. And what I would do is say, okay, we'll go home tomorrow. We can't go today because it's too dark outside. Why don't we start packing? And she would get very happy. We'd walk around the house, and she'd pick up a potholder to take and a remote control to take, and we put it in a little bag, and she'd be happy for the rest of the night. By morning, she didn't remember a thing. And so we would do that every so often, or I'd say, what are you going to do the first thing you do when you get there? Or I'd make a joke about my grandparents about what they're probably doing right now. And it was more about comforting her, because she was afraid. She didn't know this home of hers, and she didn't know why she couldn't go home.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Molly, thank you very much. You had the right approach, for sure. Thank you. Charles in Oshkosh, we will go to you now. Hi, Charles.
Hi, thank you. Great program. As far as people with Alzheimer's versus dementia, I get the impression dementia is actually worse. And also, the friend her siblings were all had Alzheimer's. Now they've taken away her ability to drive. The doctor has. I don't know. She's very upset and depressed about that.
So a couple of questions there. Thank you, Charles.
Yeah. So dementia is an umbrella term for a group of over 100 different diseases. So Alzheimer's is not worse than dementia. If you went to the doctor and the doctor said that you had cancer, your next question would be, what type of cancer? And the same thing can be said for dementia. So you would say, what type of dementia? Alzheimer's disease is the most common cause of dementia. It's not necessarily better or worse than other causes of dementia. It really depends on the person. With regards to driving, people losing their licenses, it's so tough, because think about how driving is related to your independence, right? And for your ability to leave the house whenever you want, go where you want to go. And so for a lot of people, losing that license is so tough for them and their feeling and how they feel about themselves and their independence. But we don't want to wait too long to take someone's license away. There are a few ways to do this. One, we don't want to explain to the person that we have to take it because they can't drive anymore. That's not going to work. I prefer a third-party approach, such as blaming the DMV, blaming it on the car and the mechanic, and saying, "Oh, it's at the mechanic's. You know, they need to fix it." And obviously, you've gotten rid of the car. when people are trying to decide, okay, do I take someone's license away? I like to call it the grandchild test. This is what people call the grandchild test, which means is very simple. It goes like this. Oh, yeah, sure. I let my mom drive. Yeah, I mean, she knows how to get there. It's okay. Okay, great. Would you let her drive with her grandchild in the car? Oh, God, no. No, no, no. Then the answer is the license has to go, right? So if you wouldn't let them drive with their grandchild or another vulnerable person in the car, then the answer is that license has to go.
That makes really good sense. We know that friendship is important. Talk about the value of friendship, especially for people with dementia.
Friendship is crucial, and we see this a lot with people living with dementia and for their caregivers, is that other people pull away. So when someone gets a diagnosis, a lot of friends are like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say. Like, what if they ask me something and I don't know how to respond? And so they pull away from the person. And that is so a shame because then the caregiver also loses that person as well. Continue to spend time with people. Just because they're living with a cognitive impairment doesn't mean they're not there anymore. It doesn't mean, you know, they've gone missing, they're lost, or anything like this. You know, I think when someone gets a diagnosis, like a cancer diagnosis, there are a lot of people who will gather around that person, and the opposite happens a lot with a dementia diagnosis, and it shouldn't be that way because loneliness can really cause someone's cognitive impairment to speed up. Loneliness is a huge factor in someone's cognitive health.
What about care facilities? I mean, what should you be looking for? If you, it's now time for the person to go to, your loved one to go to a memory care facility, let's say.
Good news. I've got two books with Johns Hopkins University Press on this subject. My most recent one is called The Caregiver's Guide to Memory Care and Dementia Communities. You can simply Google Rachel Wunderlin and you'll find it. The short answer is, if you've been thinking about it, if you've been thinking about transitioning someone into memory care, it's probably been time. Because a lot of people will wait pretty long to transition somebody. And sometimes by the time they move that person, they don't get the same benefit, maybe, of the social experience that they would had they moved a little bit earlier. But even if that person's at home with you, making sure that you have help, like a home care agency, reliable couple neighbors, somebody to help so that it is not just all on the caregiver. Taking care of somebody living with dementia is very, very hard, and it is not the same thing as raising a healthy child, which is already really hard, right? That's already hard, but when you're raising a child, there is a community around that. Right, there's a community that builds itself around that to some degree frequently. And when someone is aging and declining, we typically see the opposite of that.
It's a difficult thing. I've often wondered, and fortunately for me and my brother Mitch, the facility that he was in at the end where people were really kind to him, didn't talk down to him, but mm-hmm. had fun with him. One of the people would bring in some drawing materials and sit down with him and draw when I wasn't there, or he was when I showed up. So I think that kind of attention is important to sort of observe folks who are mm-hmm. at the facility. It's Rachel, here we are out of time. It has been a pleasure, as always, talking with you, and I hope you'll come back and be with us again. It's
absolutely.
It's been an important, and Rachel Wunderlin is an internationally recognized dementia expert and educator. Just go online to Rachel Wunderlin, and you're going to find her books and a whole lot more. Coming up, we're going to turn our attention away from dementia and Alzheimer's and take a look at your teeth. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking with a dentist today about your oral health and hygiene. And our guest is Dr. Tom Reed. He's president of the Wisconsin Dental Association, and he has a practice. He practices at East Grove Dental in Madison. So great to have him with us. And we'll talk with Dr. Reed about the latest technology that can help you keep your teeth clean and your gums vibrant and healthy. We'll also take your questions as well. Maybe you need help finding a new toothbrush. We can help. Or let us know your questions about cavities or gum disease and a whole lot more. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Dr. Tom Reed, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Larry, good afternoon. Good to be with you, and thank you for the opportunity. I sincerely appreciate it.
You know, it seems you can get really fancy with your dental care products, or maybe you can just rely on the old-fashioned toothbrush and floss. Are those the basic tools you need in order to have a healthy mouth?
You know, absolutely. There is no substitute for good brushing and good flossing as far as keeping your teeth and keeping your gums healthy. I have patients ask me all day long, what is the best toothbrush? And to be perfectly honest, the best toothbrush is the one that works well for you. It's rather intuitive. I see people who do very, very well with manual toothbrushes, and they maintain good oral and dental health with a manual toothbrush. I also see some folks who can benefit from some of the more automatic toothbrushes, whether it's an ultrasonic brush or whether it's an oscillating head brush. There are certainly some benefits to those, particularly in folks that struggle with some arthritic hands or they have trouble gripping a traditional brush. They can certainly benefit from some of those larger handles and just the automatic nature of some of those oscillating heads or some of those ultrasonic head toothbrushes that can be much more beneficial for folks.
I've got one of those oscillating toothbrushes, and I think it goes a minute, and then it makes a noise, and then it keeps going again. And sort of, I can't remember if it's a minute or 2 minutes, but I usually do, you know, I'll do the second one as well. Is it worth? I mean, what about time? How much time should you be spending brushing your teeth?
Yeah, you bring up a good point, is that really I tell all my patients, it's kind of the rules of two. At a minimum, we kind of expect you to brush twice a day, morning and then before bed, and then for 2 minutes at a time. That's one of those other nice features about that brush that you have, Larry, is that it has a built-in timer. So in particular for kids who, and we've all been kids, you know how that is. You kind of rush through your brushing and try to get that done in 10 seconds or less. But what's nice about those automatic toothbrushes is they have those built-in two-minute timers. Some of them are even a little bit more sophisticated and will have 30-second increments. So for the first 30 seconds, you focus on the upper right. And then that next, the timer goes off, and then you focus on the upper left for the next 30 seconds, and then down to the lower left, and then finish with the lower right, each in those 30-second increments. And that works out really nicely for some folks. I would encourage parents, too, who are struggling with kids and just maintaining proper brushing technique and proper behavior. Boy, those brushes can come in real handy. What they're even starting to do with some of the more expensive toothbrushes, and gosh, I think there's a Sonicare toothbrush on the market for over $300 right now.
Ooh.
I know it kind of is amazing, right? I don't know that anyone needs a $300 toothbrush, but some of the technology in that is actually linked to Bluetooth. So many of your listeners may have the experience of wearing a sleep monitor watch or a sleep monitor ring and get some biofeedback from that ring or that watch. Well, the same now can be done with your toothbrush, and it somewhat builds in that accountability factor so that if you're not logging on to the Sonicare app or the Oral-B app or whatever it is and seeing that, oh, yeah, I did my 2 minutes today and I did it twice a day, it just builds in some good habits. It builds in some good behavioral change.
Richard in Antigo has a question, I believe, for you. Let's go there. Hi, Richard.
Hi, good afternoon. When I was having my teeth worked on, my dentist recommended he had Usenot fluoride rinse in the evening before I go to bed at least 3 times a week. And then he recommended also having a fluoride treatment. And my wife really didn't like it because it gave it was like a film left on her teeth that really was terrible. And I says, I'm not going to do that. Is there any real reason why I need that fluoride treatment?
Yeah, so Richard, a couple different things there. Certainly the fluoride rinse is absolutely fantastic. And we've known through over 80 years and 3,000 studies that topical fluoride application on teeth is incredibly beneficial for all age groups. In particular, if you have a lot of fillings or a lot of crowns, maintaining those crowns and fillings really is very helpful with a fluoride rinse. Now, it's very specific the way you have to use that fluoride rinse. So what I typically recommend is that people floss and then they brush. And then after they're done brushing, they use that fluoride rinse with it for a good 30 seconds to a minute, and then don't eat or drink afterwards before you go to bed. So you're left with that rinse actually in contact with the teeth, helping remineralize some of the acids and some of the breakdown that you've had occur during the day so that you can avoid some cavities around old fillings or old crowns or even new cavities. So that kind of addresses the fluoride rinse. Did you have any questions about that?
No, the rinse I could understand, but what about the fluoride treatment?
Yeah, let's talk about the fluoride treatment. So probably when you were a kid, you remember going to the dentist, and fluoride treatments were these large trays, and it was kind of a goopy fluoride. I use the term goopy because that's clearly technical, but it was kind of a real gel-like fluoride that you would put in these trays, and you would pop them in your mouth for 5 minutes, and then you take them out, and those were your fluoride treatments as a kid. Well, we've evolved a little bit to these fluoride varnishes. So what your wife had and what she was describing to you is called a fluoride varnish, where a hygienist or a dentist will actually paint that varnish on your teeth, and it's intended to stay on there for 2, 3, sometimes 4 hours. So indeed, it feels a little sticky. It feels a little goopy. You can still eat and drink after you have it applied, but what we don't want you to do is to brush it off of there. So a lot of times when I apply a varnish here in the office, what I'll tell folks is it's going to feel like you have little sweaters on your teeth for the next couple hours, and that's by intention. That's so that fluoride is sticking to your teeth and really penetrating the enamel and making it stronger and less prone to cavities. So two different things there, the rinse that a lot of people will use and is very, very beneficial, and then the prescription strength fluoride, that varnish that we apply here in the office.
Richard, thank you very much for calling. Just kind of related, I think. I see ads for mouthwashes that claim that they're going to help you with plaque maybe, or other kinds of issues around the mouth. Is there any proven effectiveness to that?
There is, for some. And like all things, it really depends upon which product you're using. The tried and true, and this was invented at the turn of the century, but Listerine. Listerine is genuinely a product that will help prevent gum disease. And it is in every single study that it's ever been tested in, Listerine is really, really quite effective. There are other products out there that I would not necessarily recommend that are really nothing short of just flavored water. And it's good to still get the mechanical action of that gargle or that rinsing with that particular type of mouth rinse. But really the therapeutic benefit, the benefit of preventing gum disease comes from something like a Listerine. There's also a prescription strength mouthwash that you can use. It's called chlorhexidine gluconate. Chlorhexidine gluconate, as I said, it's only available by prescription, whether it's your physician or your dentist. And that's for people with severe gum disease. We can also use it sometimes in people preparing for gum surgeries or for oral surgeries to really help reduce the bacterial load in your mouth so that you heal better. But again, that's more of a prescription strength.
Let's go to Mona in Appleton next. Hi, Mona.
Hi, I just tuned in, so I'm not sure the whole your guest what he's totally covering. But I had a root canal go bad and had it pulled. And it wasn't actually pulled. They had to, while it was still infected, so they had a hard time getting it numbed. But he got it numbed enough, and he drilled it all out, and then he found a third root, and he got everything but a tiny tip, and then he sewed it shut. He told me about it, and I'm very concerned that this is going to come back as a problem that I need oral surgery for. It's healing okay, and it's still, I still got that little white area, and it's slowly closing up. You know, like I can tell it's getting better and better. My mouth is just sore from chewing on the same other side all the time. But yeah. I'm just wondering, it's getting really, oh, God, I eat something like a pork chop and on the other side, and my mouth is sore all day. So,
what about that root, though, Dr. Reed?
Yeah, so, Mona, gosh, I'm sorry you're experiencing that, and that's never a fun experience. I will tell you, it's not uncommon, root canals can go bad and can lead to an extraction. I venture to guess you probably had what we call a vertical root fracture in your tooth or a fracture that went all the way through the tooth that we couldn't necessarily tell. I will say we try to get root tips out as much as possible. However, there are instances where root tips can be left in and the body can heal over them quite nicely. I am assuming that your dentist wants to keep a very, very close eye on this, and that's what I would recommend. Not knowing all the details of your situation or of your surgical experience, I don't know, what size the root tip was. Sometimes that's of critical importance. But if you're healing over and if your dentist is following up with that carefully, taking appropriate radiographs on at least an annual basis of that area, it could heal up very nicely for you.
Mona, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Tom Reed, our guest today. Great to have him with us. As we talk about your teeth and your dental health, I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at your teeth. Dr. Tom Reed, our guest, president of the Wisconsin Dental Association. It's great to have him with us today. And you can join in. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Let's turn to Lane in Wisconsin Rapids next. Hi, Lane.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I am wondering, what exactly does impacted wisdom teeth mean? And if you do have that, how do you know if it is something that needs to be addressed or extracted, especially if it hasn't been causing any discomfort or if you've had it if they've been impacted for a long time?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Lane, that's a great question. I will tell you, most people are born with four wisdom teeth. Now, not everyone. Some people have no wisdom teeth. Some people have any number variation from zero, and I've seen as many as eight in some folks. So that's really quite a wide range of wisdom teeth. wisdom teeth or third molars are rather leftover remnants of our evolution. When we had larger jaw bones, we had more room for our teeth. Now that we have evolved to have somewhat of a smaller jawbone, most of us do not have room for our wisdom teeth. So that's why we typically will recommend that they be extracted. There are different types of impactions. You can have a tooth that is fully impacted with bone over the top of it, or you can have a tooth that is partially impacted where it's partially or half in the mouth and half still under bone. Both of those can be problems in the long term for you. There was a recent study published that actually indicated people with impacted wisdom teeth have an increased mortality risk. And what that's tied to actually is the increased risk of gum disease around partially impacted wisdom teeth. So for most people, and I will tell you, I have had four of my kids have their wisdom teeth out, and most people I in my office, I recommend that they have their wisdom teeth out because quite frankly, most of us just don't have room for them. So that's a little bit of a short story about wisdom teeth. So any other questions you had for me, Lane?
No, that's all. Thanks for the information.
All right. Thanks. No. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. And Beth in Lac des Flambeaux, we'll go to you. Hi, Beth.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks for all the great information. I have been using a high concentration fluoride toothpaste that my dentist prescribed, and I was wondering if I wanted to use it with the fluoride rinse that you had mentioned earlier. Is there an order I should use them in? In other words, should I brush first and then rinse, or should I rinse first and then brush, or rinse at a different time of day? I do this at night before I go to bed. So thank you for your answer.
Yeah, Beth, absolutely. I'm really happy that your dentist, particularly if you're having trouble with cavities, prescribed you an increased strength of fluoride toothpaste. Typically, that product is called Prevident. Clinpro 5000, I think, is also another prescription blend of toothpaste. The type of fluoride used in a prescription toothpaste is 1.1% sodium fluoride. So it's a bit stronger than what you typically see in your over-the-counter toothpaste. Additionally, in that sodium fluoride form, it tends to just help prevent decay a little bit better. Now, you spoke to the order, and I think Richard had a little bit of a similar question. The order that I like to see people use is to brush first and then to use that fluoride rinse afterwards, and then again, not to eat or drink after you use that fluoride rinse. So I hope that answers your question.
There you go, Beth. Thank you so much for calling. E in Madison emailed us. E and her sister are both in their 30s. E goes to cleanings twice a year. Her sister hasn't been to the dentist since she was 14. She says it's too inconvenient and her teeth feel fine. How does E convince her sister to make the time to go in?
Oh, boy. I'm sorry that her sister has not been in to see a dentist since she was 14. To be honest, she could be having lots of gingivitis, which is early gum disease. What we tend to see happen is over time, our bodies and bacteria in our mouth produce calculus, our hard deposits on our teeth. Those hard deposits on our teeth, the only way we can get those off of there is by having a skilled hygienist or a skilled dentist remove those hard deposits. Those deposits are filled with bacteria and bacterial toxins, and I bet if E talked to her sister, if her sister flosses, every single time she flosses, she probably sees blood on her floss. You should not have bleeding gums if you have a healthy mouth. And the only way you're going to have a healthy mouth is if a skilled hygienist and or dentist is removing that plaque and calculus buildup that absolutely all of us get. Absolutely across the board, all of us get to one form or another. I tend to think I'm a pretty good brusher and flosser, and I will tell you, I get calculus buildup. It's all about self-care. And so I really hope that E's sister would consider listening to her sister and engage in some really good self-care and visit a dentist soon.
And to go along with that, we got an email from Pat. For a male age 50 years old of fairly good health overall, how often should Pat go to the dentist for annual checkups?
Yeah, you know, the old standard twice a year is a really good rule of thumb, every 6 months going to the dentist. Now, there are, quite frankly, people who benefit from going more often. I have some patients I see every 3 months. I have some patients I see every 4 months. On the opposite end of that twice a year, I have some patients I see every 8 months or every 12 months. Those are a little bit more rare. That people can wait 12 months in between visits. But really, every 6 months is a good place to start.
Another newish dental technology is, the water pick or the water pick type of appliances. How do they work compared to traditional floss?
Yeah, so there is nothing that is going to replace traditional floss. First of all, it's really, really inexpensive. So you do not need to go and buy a $100 water pick or a $200 water pick. I will say that water picks are a fantastic adjunct to both brushing and flossing, but it is certainly not a substitute for brushing and flossing. The way I like to see water picks used is if people have a tremendous number of crowns or if they have a lot of bridge work or implant work, it's really good for flushing out around that type of dental treatment to really help in addition to flossing, but it is certainly not a replacement for flossing. Now, I have people tell me all day long, boy, I hate to floss, but I'll use my water pick. And if it's water pick or nothing, obviously I'm going to say, okay, well, use the water pick. That's fantastic. And maybe try to start to incorporate flossing once a week, twice a week, three times a week. But really, there's no replacement, Larry, for flossing and brushing.
Sheila in Beloit has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Sheila.
Hi. I had a situation where I had cracked a back molar that had a filling in it, and it was over 4th of July. So I found a dentist locally, was able to get in, and got a crown on it. The crown, when I was using the water pick, came flying off of the tooth. And I went to my old dentist and had it put on again. He said there was no cement on the top of the crown wherever it's supposed to fit. And I'm wondering, how do you find a decent dentist? What is the best way?
Sounds like you have a good one, the second one, anyway, who noticed something. But what about it, Dr. Reed?
Yeah, so Sheila, again, sorry you had that experience. I will tell you, crowns are normally very, very successful, and they're a fantastic way to preserve your natural teeth and just to help you keep your teeth longer. To answer your question, the absolute best way to find a dentist is to listen to your friends and relatives. Get people who you know and trust and ask them who they see for a dentist. That's one of the best ways. The other way, quite frankly, you can use the Wisconsin Dental Association, and I know many people in Beloit who I could recommend for you, but if you were to call the Wisconsin Dental Association, you can and certainly get recommendations that way. Additionally, the American Dental Association actually offers a product called Find a Dentist. And you can go to ada.org, AmericanDentalAssociation.org, ada.org, and actually look at Find a Dentist. put in your zip code, and they will give you a list of American Dental Association dentists and Wisconsin Dental Association dentists in your area that are very, very reputable. So that those are a couple good ways. But boy, for me personally, there's nothing like having a friend or family give me a good recommendation. And I love following up on those.
Yeah. Sheila, thank you for calling. Louise in Elkhart Lake, we go to you. Hi, Louise.
Good afternoon, Larry and Doctor. I have a question for you about lichen planus. I've probably been diagnosed with it over 30 years ago, and it's really starting to act up. When I go to the dentist, and I do get cleanings 3 times a year, I hear, my, that's really bad. I bet that really hurts. And that's about as far as they ever go with treating it. And I'm wondering if there's anything out there medication-wise, or, I mean, I floss, I brush, and I've stopped using my water pick because it's just too painful. But what do you recommend?
And first, maybe talk about, Dr. Reed, what is lichen planus?
Yeah, absolutely. So, Luis, lichen planus, boy, not an uncommon condition we see in people. What I will tell you is it's first and foremost an autoimmune condition. That manifest as white lacy patches either on the cheeks or sometimes the gum tissue. There is a condition called erosive lichen planus, and those we get a little bit more concerned about because, quite frankly, those ulcerative lesions can sometimes be pre-malignant, and so they can be precancerous. So we do get concerned about lichen planus. Unfortunately, there are not a lot of good options as far as medications. The one medication that is somewhat successful is a topical steroid. And you can put a topical steroid on those lichen planus lesions, and that can help with some of your symptoms, some of the burning, some of the discomfort. And it does minimize how erosive that lichen planus can be sometimes. So I hope that helps a little bit.
Yeah, Louise, thank you for calling. Norman called, couldn't stay with us, but what do you think about the 2-in-1 toothbrush that has an interdental brush and a normal toothbrush? Can you use that instead of flossing?
Again, there is nothing that's going to get in between your teeth better than floss. I like those interdental toothbrushes. Quite frankly, again, if it's between not flossing and using the interdental toothbrush, sure, that's a great adjunct. But again, it's not a substitute for flossing.
Let's go to Louise in Albany next. Hi, Louise.
Hi. I have a 27-year-old daughter who has high-functioning Down syndrome, and I have hard time finding a dentist who will take, obviously, her Medicare and Medicaid. And there's the list you can go off of that they provide, but I've had some very bad experiences when she was younger, and so don't feel comfortable, you know, just going off a list. She got kicked off at 21 from her the one she was seeing as a child, and so since then we've really struggled finding anybody who will accept the insurance. Any recommendations?
Yeah, Louise, boy, that is a challenge in Wisconsin right now. And it's certainly a challenge that we at the Wisconsin Dental Association are addressing. We would love to see some reimbursement rates from Medicaid that make it more doable for all practitioners to see daughters just like yours. It certainly is a challenge. One of the places that people used to go to, frankly, was the general practice residency that was at Meritor Hospital. And that was a fantastic facility for folks with special needs and folks who had Medicaid benefits. I will tell you, one of the other places you can look at is Marquette University School of Dentistry, and that would be a wonderful option, too. Additionally, many communities have federally qualified healthcare centers with dental offices in them, FQHCs with dental offices in them. I would also explore that potential option. Okay, but yeah, that is definitely a real struggle for folks.
Yeah, and we also had an email from Michelle, kind of along the same line. Her adult sister is severely autistic, and they're struggling to find anyone who will do dental care for her, not only the Medicare Medicaid, but also someone to work on someone who is severely autistic.
Yeah, some folks are so developmentally disabled, they have to be sedated and brought into an operating room type situation. Again, that's where I would look at more of a resource like Marquette. Just a very difficult situation to navigate.
So Marquette University Dental School.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Bob in Fitchburg, we'll go to you. Hi, Bob.
Hi, good afternoon. So a while back, I had a new crown put onto a second from the back molar. And over a period of maybe a year, year and a half, that tooth and the last molar have moved apart from each other, and I've developed a fairly large gap there, and it's really become troublesome because anytime I eat anything, food gets trapped in there, and I'm wondering if there are any suggestions for solutions for that kind of a situation.
Yeah, absolutely, Bob. This is something this is an incredibly frustrating situation for dentists because teeth can move. It's not uncommon. It's happened to me after I've placed new crowns that the teeth can shift apart, and then you start to trap a tremendous amount of food in between those teeth. The problem there is you can get decay underneath that crown because you're not able to keep it clean. So I'll tell you what I do with my patients who develop that. Quite frankly, I remake the crown. That might not be what your dentist wants to do, and perhaps they have another solution for you. But more often than not, I'll end up taking that old crown off and remaking the crown. Otherwise, you are going to have some problems as you pack food in between those teeth.
Bob, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Mike from Sun Prairie emailed us. First, does regular whitening of your teeth remove enamel and weaken the teeth? And there's been lots of advertisement about using hydroxyapatite is kind of a way of looking is what I have here on my screen to remineralize your teeth. Is there truth to that, and what would be the best brand?
Yeah, let's address the hydroxyapatite first there, Larry. Absolutely. Hydroxyapatite is fantastic for remineralizing the enamel on your teeth. It's very effective, much like fluoride, and is very beneficial. I don't have a specific brand in mind as far as recommending for hydroxyapatite, but it is effective. And yeah, tell Mike he can certainly use that, or if Mike's listening, he can certainly use that. The second question about whitening products, I'm very cautious with whitening products. I, in particular, like two systems. For an over-the-counter system, I like the Crest whitening strips. Those are very, very effective. They give you a good result, and they are 100% safe on your teeth. So that's the one over-the-counter system I like. And then, if you want to take it a step further, there are prescription whitening trays that your dentist can make for you. And again, those are safe and effective. As far as being destructive against enamel, neither of those two systems is detrimental to your teeth. That said, I have seen some over-the-counter systems that are a bit acidic and can be a little destructive of enamel. So a couple things. A, I would look for the American Dental Association seal of approval. Certainly, if it has been through the rigorous testing at the American Dental Association and it has the ADA seal of approval, rest assured it's going to be safe for you. And then the other option is, yeah, talk to your dental professional and see what they have to say. But those are the two systems I use for teeth whitening, and both are very safe for teeth.
Dr. Tom Reed, our guest, president of the Wisconsin Dental Association. If you have a question for him, you can join in. We'll get you on pretty quickly. The number to call, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Just a quick note, our next book club novel is titled Bridgeton, and it's written by Michael Nodler. The story follows three childhood friends who always find a way to come back and visit their hometown, and it's set in Wisconsin. I've been reading. I just started a few chapters in, and I'm really enjoying it. I'll be talking with you, with the author and with you about it on June 19th. So if you haven't picked up a copy of Bridgeton, do so and join in the conversation on June 19th. Right now, talking about your teeth with our guest, Dr. Tom Reed. It's great to have him with us. Nora emailed us, Dr. Reed. She switched from using Listerine to using salt water, and she puts it in her water pick. Last time her teeth were checked, the gums were perfect and her pockets were better. Could the salt water be beneficial?
There are times that I recommend salt water. Some folks will tell me that Listerine burns a little too much. It has that medicinal strength to it, and that's part of why it's working, because you do feel that little bit of burn. But salt water is absolutely acceptable. Yeah, so that Nora is on the right track there, absolutely.
Another emailer wants to know, should we change our dental care as we age?
You know, if you are doing very well with your brushing and flossing, and you're not seeing an increase in either gum disease or cavities, I don't know that it's necessarily age-dependent. What I will say is we do see some needs change as we age, especially if you do have gum disease and we see a little bit of recession with the teeth. We start to see what are called root cavities, and those can be very problematic. The other thing as we age is oftentimes we're put on more medications. We're put on more prescriptions, which can cause dry mouth. If you start seeing more dry mouth, then we eventually start seeing more cavities. So it's not necessarily a function of aging specifically, but more of a symptom of some of the other conditions that come along with aging, whether it's a change in prescriptions or a change in your gum health. It's interesting, as we were listening there at the commercial break, Larry, I heard Hoy Apothecary as one of your sponsors. I've known Kevin Hoy for many, many years. He's actually about a half mile from my office. For some older folks who are looking for a wonderful pharmacy for their dental health needs, boy, I would definitely recommend that you visit Kevin down the road. He's fantastic, I'll give him a plug here that he didn't pay for on your show. But it is very dental specific, because he is. He's great at helping us compound some different dental needs, medications for dental needs. So, yeah, I'll get that in.
Okay. Here's another question from somebody who's trying to remember. When the hygienist checks for pockets, do they take the measurements? And I'm trying to think about this now. They use something, it's almost like, feels like a little needle hitting your gums. Do they take them from the front of your teeth or the backside of your teeth?
They will do both. So essentially what we're doing, and again, I'll tell you what I do in my office. Once a year, I require all of my patients to have what's called a periodontal charting done. And what that periodontal charting is checking for is how healthy are your gums and how healthy is the bone that is holding your teeth in place. They take that probe and they will go around and actually, for every single tooth, they will do 6 separate measurements. There are 3 on the front, and then 3 on the back. So they will do the front side of the tooth on its most posterior or most rear position. They'll do a measurement in the center, and then they'll do a measurement on the front. And then they'll replicate those then on the tongue side as well. So there are actually 6 separate measurements they're taking.
Wow, I didn't realize that when I was having it done. I didn't realize there were 6. But it doesn't hurt. And it's good if you're not getting any blood. I know that for sure.
That is true. The other thing you want to listen for is that those measurements are between 1 and 3 millimeters. So those are those numbers those hygienists are either reading to their computer or reading for someone else to chart for you. They'll say 1, 2, 2, 3, 1. As long as those measurements are between 1 and 3 millimeters, that indicates to me that you have healthy teeth.
Let's take a question from Anton in Eau Claire. Hi, Anton.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about my concerns about dental cost. A couple of weeks ago, I went to my dentist. I had a cleaning, an exam, and the full circle of pictures. And I paid $490. And I had asked about insurance being on Medicare, but the dentist wouldn't take that. And during that visit, even though my measurements are very good, I was told I really should come in more often than twice a year, preferably 4 times, and have maybe 2 exams. And I went home and I did some calculations that would cost me almost $1,700 a year. I can afford that, but I'm thinking so many people, I hear you say you need to go to the dentist maybe even 3 times a year, but there are so many people who couldn't possibly afford that. And I'm really concerned about so many young dentists building fantastic new practices, all glass and very beautiful, and you know that somebody has to pay for it.
Yeah. Dr. Reed?
Yeah, so Anton, I recognize the struggle there. One of the reasons you may be being told that you need to see your dentist more often, it could be as if you have diabetes or heart disease or some underlying conditions that we know can make gum disease worse and in turn sometimes make those other underlying conditions worse. So I don't know your particular case, and you don't need to share that, but that might be one of the reasons you're being recommended to go more often. One of the solutions that the Wisconsin Dental Association is addressing is the cost of dental insurance or is the cost of dental care. So what we rolled out, it was about 1.5 years ago, was the Wisconsin Dental Savings Club. And what that Wisconsin Dental Savings Club is a discounted fee structure so that it enables people like you, Anton, or like you say, some folks that struggle with seeking dental care and don't have a third-party payer involved or don't have insurance involved, they can go to WDA.org and actually look up our Savings Club plan. I'm pretty sure we have quite a few providers in the Eau Claire area that would be more than happy to see folks like you or other folks that are struggling to seek out dental care. But yeah, check out the WDA Savings Club. It's really a unique program. It's forward thinking, and it really helps folks address the cost of some dental care.
All right. Anton, thank you for calling. Marcy in Fond du Lac, your turn. Hi, Marcy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is tonsillitis. What causes them, and what can you do to prevent them?
Tonsillitis?
Tonsillitis.
Oh, tonsillitis.
Yeah, so Marcy, tonsil lifts or tonsil stones, as some people will call them, tonsil stones, essentially it's an accumulation of food in the crypts of your tonsils that sits there, and they get rather they're not overly pleasant for some folks. Like one of the things you can do is obviously you can remove them, but you'd be extraordinarily careful with your when you're doing that. You don't want to damage the back of your throat. You don't want to damage your tonsil. The other thing you can do is gargle. Certainly doing a little rinse with either we've already brought up salt water, we've already brought up Listerine. Those two things can be extraordinarily helpful. But some people are just more prone to them than others, and typically it's based on the anatomy of your tonsils. And if you have tonsils that have deeper crevices or deeper grooves, you're a little bit more prone to those tonsil lifts or tonsil stones.
Victor, Marcy, thank you for calling. Victor sent us a question. What are the best methods for coffee and wine stain removal, both at home and the dentist? I think this goes back to your earlier comments about tooth whitening, perhaps.
Yeah, it sure does. So as I mentioned, those crest whitening strips are fantastic, as are any professional prescription strength bleaching or tooth whitening that you can do at your dentist office. The other thing to consider is after consuming coffee or wine, do a little water rinse afterwards and just really reduce those stains that are present in your mouth and on the teeth, and just doing something as simple as chasing coffee or wine with a little bit of water can help prevent some of that staining.
Jenny in Verona, we'll go to you now. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. I was wondering what the doctor thinks about Xylemelt.
Yeah, let's talk about Xylemelt. They are absolutely fantastic. So I brought up having dry mouth, and I assume that's what you're kind of talking about, those Xylemelts. Xylemelts are composed of an alcohol called xylitol. And what we know about xylitol is it helps fight cavities. We also know that it helps fight dry mouth or xerostomia. So these Xylemelts are these little tablets that you can put in your cheek. I'm almost positive you can get them on Amazon. I certainly have samples here in my office that I will give patients who suffer from dry mouth. And I think they're absolutely fantastic. They're very, very helpful for folks who suffer from dry mouth.
Would that apply as well to, like, if you're drinking sweet liquids, it's summertime, lemonade, that sort of thing? Would that help also in terms of, you know, protecting your teeth?
Yeah, xylitol can be found in gum, and you can certainly chew a xylitol gum. And yes, that does help prevent cavities. Xylitol is a wonderful anti-cariogenic component.
Jenny, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And here we are, out of time. I want to, Dr. Tom Reed, thank you so much. Would you come back and be with us again? I'd love to have you back.
Larry, I'd love to. I feel like we just got started.
I have a whole list of questions here in front of me, and I know there were other people who didn't make it on the air. But thank you so much, and let's do it again. Appreciate it very much.
Sounds good, my friend. Have a great day.
Dr. Tom Reed, president of the Wisconsin Dental Association, and he practices at East Grove Dental in Madison. Great to have him with us. And thank you for joining us today. And thanks to our team for creating our shows every day. Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and I certainly want to thank you for listening. And I want you to stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.